Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. It's Dr. Deborah here.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly. How you doing?
Oh, you know what? I'm mixed. I have lots to share about the week. But before we go anywhere, I really just want to send my heart, my prayers, my love to everybody out there who was part of the Las Vegas massacre, had family or friends, lost anybody. That was so startling.
It was so tragic. Oh, I'm so upset.
Oh, so upset. And if anybody has any questions about how to deal with this kind of sense of loss, the fear that it inspires about being in this world, being in crowded places, please, please send us your emails to docandtherapist@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. And also, if you have any questions today for our guests or otherwise, you can always call us at 323-203-0815. Yeah, such a tragedy. So sad. So scary.
It really
and
is.
And more gets revealed. Someday I do want us to talk about this on the show when they find out more about what his relationship might have been like with his father, who was a...
Yes, fugitive.
Yes, yeah. An armed robber and sociopathic, and whether... You know, maybe he was trying to live up to his father's legacy, that sort of strangeness of fame.
Or was it like revenge? Because I think his father was arrested in Las Vegas. Something,
More will be revealed. That would be an excellent conversation for us to talk about. But anyway, so on the positive end, Mr. Prowler, Kitty Prowler, has gained a pound.
This is Dr. Deborah's cat,
by the way. In the midst of his cancer treatment, he's taking the herbs really nicely. He's had acupuncture.
Great.
And he's put on weight. He's eating like a horse. And he didn't vomit this morning, which
is
amazing. I know.
I'm so happy to hear that.
So good.
So we'll keep those positive thoughts going.
Yeah. And then I also had a tragic loss in my family. There's two families that I grew up with. And this young lady was my idol. She passed of MS just this last week. And she was as close to any family member I could ever have who isn't actually family. So that there was a bunch of us kids. We all played together. We did holidays together. We traveled together. We went to the beach together. And she got sick about 25 years ago.
Oh.
And she's young, 61 years old. And so we went to the funeral. What was wonderful was I got to see all these people again. It was like we were kids again. And and just, you know, for terrible circumstances. But so hopefully she's in a better place.
Gosh, you had a rough week.
It was
yes.
Yes. Aww. But I'm healthy. I'm happy.
Good.
This is good. I got some test results back that shows that I have very low risk, if no risk, for pulmonary disease because
I
was a former smoker. So I wanted to get checked out and for strokes and all that stuff. So
you're
good,
doing
solid
well.
Thank
God.
So yeah.
Good.
I'm here to stick around and keep babbling. How about you, honey?
So my good news of the weekend was, so my almost five-year-old brought his girlfriend over for a play date.
Almost right, November, five.
Can you believe it?
Unbelievable, half of a decade.
Yes. But they were so cute. They were like holding hands. She's like a foot taller.
Oh.
So David jokes, the Millers like tall women. And it's just really, it was really cute.
Oh,
and then
God.
They have this thing, like, I don't know, London heard something on the radio, like a gentleman always holds the door for a lady. I don't know, some song. So he was holding the door. It was like hilarious.
Oh my God, did you catch any of this on video?
I didn't catch it in a video, but I do have a picture. I'll show you afterward.
Oh my God.
So it was really cute.
He is such a charmer.
Charmer. Yes.
Beyond.
I always joke that he could charm the pants off anybody.
And he probably will.
Yeah, sadly, I know.
You will be having box loads of condoms.
Oh God, help me. No, the kid's only five. Lord.
Well,
let's talk about last week.
Yes, we have the fabulous guest. Sharon Begley, she's a journalist and a reporter, science. She wrote this amazing book called Can't Just Stop, An Investigation of Compulsions. And I shared with her about my compulsion, my obsessive compulsive experience these days that has really worsened as I leave the house and my fear that I have left the stove on and I will burn down the house. Well, I practiced tools that she said, which is to just say, after you've checked everything, if it starts coming up, just say my brain is playing tricks on me and I don't need to listen to it.
Uh-huh.
And I would walk out the door. And so I am almost an entire week free
of
not going back and checking.
That's cured. Incredible.
I'm going to send her the biggest thank you note.
Oh my God, you should. That's incredible.
Isn't that incredible?
Wow. God, what a relief. She changed your life.
She changed
you know?
My life. Oh my yes. God. Hopefully incredible. The house doesn't burn down.
Right. No, you're fine. If you've lasted this long, I think you're going to be
okay.
Oh,
probably okay. Yeah.
Wow.
So pretty powerful, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. So she was great. Check out that show and check out her book if you haven't already. And today, well, it took a little bit of time back and forth about whether these amazing guests were going to be on today. They are here with us. So we have Dr. John and Julie Gottman, world-renowned for his work on marital stability and divorce. I can't even read it.
Prediction.
I don't have my glasses on. Prediction. Dr. John Gottman has conducted 40 years of breakthrough research with thousands of couples. He is the author of over 200 published academic articles and author or co-author of more than 40 books. Wow. Including the New York Times bestseller, The 7 Principles for Making Marriage Work. Dr. Julie Schwartz Gottman is a highly respected clinical psychologist and author. She is sought internationally as an expert advisor on marriage, domestic violence, trauma, gay and lesbian adoption, same-sex marriage, and parenting issues. She is co-creator of the immensely popular The Art and Science of Love weekend workshop for couples, and she also co-designed the National Clinical Training Program in Gottman Method Couples Therapy. Welcome, Drs. John and Julie. Thank you for being on our show.
Thank you so much.
Inviting us.
Thank you so much, Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly.
We're so excited. So I'm just going to dive right in because I have a ton of questions for you. But I want to know, in your opinion, what is the most important piece of advice that you can offer therapists or even other couples? I mean, basically, what's your sort of maybe go-to, I don't know, line of defense when working with couples?
Well, I think it's really to assess first before intervening. And we have a checkup website of questionnaires that are thoroughly validated. And we think if you can't measure it, you can't build it. 37,000 couples have already taken these questionnaires.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah, I think the important thing about assessment, and I would agree with John, is, you know, it's a whole lot like going into a doctor's office and you've got a stomach ache. A doctor doesn't give you any tests. The doctor doesn't ask you any questions. The doctor just says, roll up your sleeve. I'm going to give you an injection. This will fix it. But my goodness, is it going to fix it? Probably not. Mm-hmm. Well, we do the same thing. As couples therapists, when our clients sit down, they start to talk about what's wrong, and we dive in with intervention without really looking carefully at what might be going on in the relationship. Is there an affair? Is maybe there some domestic violence? What is really going on? We need to understand that first before we can help people.
I couldn't agree with you more, and that's a great metaphor about the doctor's office, because Kelly and I both do couples therapy as well, and it's always interesting. People will, you know, come to me after having seen, you know, a number of other people, and they say they just kept telling us things to do, but nobody really understood what was really going on between us. You know, we went in because we have sexual dysfunction, but God, it's so much more about their relationship than it is about the symptom. Mm-hmm. So totally agree.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So what were some of the principles of couples therapy that didn't quite make it into 10 Principles of Couples Therapy?
That's the book, by the way.
Oh, yes, that's the book.
So there are just a few things. You know, one of the most important things that I just assumed people would be understanding who read the book, so I didn't articulate it, was that the most important thing for couples to experience from the therapist is being witnessed by them, being deeply understood, being empathized with, and how very important it is to be empathetic with both people, even if you feel like one person is much more the problem than the other person. So that even if there's been an affair in the relationship, one is deeply hurt, the other is the one who caused the hurt, you have to be able to also empathize with that person who did the hurting to understand what was going on for them in their world. Mm-hmm. and the relationship that created the circumstances in which the affair may have occurred.
Absolutely. Understanding the context in which something happens can humanize the person again, whereas the partner may see them as just a pure perpetrator or somebody who just did something despicable.
Right, right. And it's really about empathy, right? Mm-hmm. It's about really being able to empathize with openness with each partner in turn and not go after one partner against the other.
I'm going to dive off topic for just a second and deal with narcissism, if we can talk about that a little bit. When you're working with a couple where one person is clearly narcissistic with the full-fledged personality disorder, do you find that you alter mm-hmm. your approach in any way? Because I find that when that occurs, that they're very difficult to have that kind of authentic empathy often.
I see a lot of couples with a situation where one may have a narcissistic personality disorder and or borderline personality disorder. So with somebody who is deeply narcissistic, and that feels like a very relevant topic these days, it's really important, again, to understand the dynamics in which somebody became narcissistically personality disordered. Mm-hmm. So understanding that means getting that at some point early in life, probably in their first year, mm-hmm. they were the bee's knees. They were absolutely the most golden child that ever existed. And shortly after that first year, maybe second year, they fell off the pedestal. Maybe another sibling was born, and they really lost out big time. And there's lots of rage about that mm-hmm. and wanting to be back in the good graces or the best graces of anybody they're in relationship to. And how deep that need is. And when you're working with somebody like that, again, it's very easy to get alienated from that person, to feel disgusted by them a little bit, or to start labeling them, to want to cut them down a peg, bring them down. But what we have to realize is beneath all that boasting, bragging, is a profound need to be the special one. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to say they're the special one, but we can share empathy with the feelings that may be underneath, that they're feeling invisible, they're not feeling listened to, mm-hmm. and so on, that they too are in a lot of pain, anguish, anger, mm-hmm. a lot of fear that they're not going to be understood. And as you, again, empathize with that person, witness that, then, only then, will they be able to hear any kind of feedback right. About ways perhaps they could consider altering their behavior or modifying their behavior in some way. So the empathy, big time, has to precede asking them to change.
But do you, in my experience, narcissists don't usually have that much insight about themselves. Like, I don't think that they see themselves the same way that the rest of the world does.
That's true, but it's not about insight. I'm not talking about insight into themselves. That's something very different. It's more cognitive. It's more deeply dynamic. All I'm talking about is empathy. Mm-hmm. And anybody, no matter who they are, wants to hear some empathy. So that's what you're doing. You're going right into the heart of that individual, though for all practical purposes, that heart may feel invisible. It may be very hard to see it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here's where a theory comes in handy. If you understand what creates somebody who's narcissistic, then you can guess at what that heart is feeling beneath that very thick wall that you're seeing. Name that, whatever that is beneath there, and see how the person responds. What I've found is that typically people really welcome that, even somebody that narcissistic.
That's good.
Yeah, I think that's true. I've experienced that too, but it seems like in the course of the therapy, there'll be times when the defensive wall really kicks back in, and you almost have to sort of do that whole process again to rebuild that trust, because sometimes instituting anything that sounds like a criticism to them, even if it's a helpful suggestion, can just knock that wall right back up. Is that your experience at times too?
Like every day. Every day. Sure. You know, it's especially hard for somebody who's narcissistic to have any empathy for the other person.
Right.
And how the other person may be suffering. And so, what we practice sometimes to help with that, where somebody really can't hear the other person's point of view, they're too locked into their own point of view, is we do what's called a Dan Weil exercise, or a Dan Weil intervention, named after our dear friend, clinical psychologist Dan Weil, who practices in Oakland, California. And he really created a method where the therapist may sit next to one of the clients. Sometimes even, you know, this is what I do, sometimes I'll actually kneel next to the person so my head's a little lower than theirs. Mm-hmm. And you become the voice as a therapist. You become the voice of that individual. And you voice what you think that individual is saying, but you do it in a different way. You build into your voicing some of the positive things you think that individual feels for the other person, and you voice what they are needing, what they're feeling and what they're needing, rather than anything that sounds like criticism. And more often than not, that kind of voicing work will help somebody, even personality disordered, to hear what the message is that that individual may be trying to give them.
So if I understand correctly, so if John is having trouble, not your John, sorry, let's go a different way. If Sam is having trouble expressing himself clearly because he suffers from narcissism and he's having trouble empathizing with Mary, are you his voice to Mary, or are you his voice back to himself?
No. Thank you for that question. Let me clarify it. Let's say Mary is trying to convey her feelings about something to Sam. Sam is narcissistic, personality disorder. Sam is really having a tough time hearing what Mary's saying and just feels attacked and gets defensive in response. So what the therapist does is be Mary's voice speaking to Sam about her feelings and what she needs, but doing it in a different way to help Sam hear it and not feel threatened by it.
I never knew that was the Wiley method, because I do a version of that.
Yeah, he said,
well,
that's
I will
great.
Now credit
Dan Weil.
Weil.
So we are
that's
talking
correct. W-I-F-E. He's a fabulous therapist, also an author.
That's great. We are talking with Dr. Julie and Dr. John Gottman. They are the founders of the Gottman Institute, an internationally renowned organization. dedicated to combining wisdom from research and practice to support and strengthen marriages and relationships. And they are the authors of many, many books. And we also want to talk about your latest book, The Science of Couples and Family Therapy. And it's coming out January of this next year. And so I'm curious what motivated you to write The Science of Couples and Family Therapy.
Well, I think that, let me answer that one. The challenge that led us to write this is the realization that we have a field with very small effect sizes. So most therapists are trained in methods that can make an unhappy couple slightly less miserable. But unfortunately, these methods can't help create a great relationship. But our theory, which is based on basic research and that Julie and I developed, the sound relationship house theory, is quite a bit more effective than current practices. Now, we have to be modest because we've only done five studies to date, but we have much bigger effect sizes. In accomplishing that goal of taking an ailing relationship and helping couples make a really happy, successful relationship.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. So, okay. So, I mean, maybe you can tell us, based upon that, some of the failures of past and current methods for conducting couples therapy.
Well, one of the problems that we all really deal with, and this is a pervasive problem throughout medicine, is the problem of relapse, that people really often don't do what's good for them. For example, if you take all the people in the world who are hypertensive or diabetic or have asthma, only half of them actually take their medicine. And the half that don't take their medicine wind up really being in a lot of trouble and at risk for strokes and other kinds of terrible things. The same is true in couples and family therapy. People may learn ways of coping with problems, but then 35 to 50% of them relapse after about 2 years. And we try to cope with that by working on making the relationship primary rather than the therapist primary and giving the tools very quickly to the couple and making ourselves obsolete.
Let me add another one. I think there are a number of people who are practicing therapy based on the assumption, the ideas that mystery is really important to keep passion alive, and a little bit of distance, a lot more emphasis on individual development, individuation, and so on, is what works best in a relationship. And none of that actually is based on any sound research. All of our 45 years of research shows that the better people know one another, the closer they feel emotionally, the more intimate they are, the more open they are emotionally to one another, the better the relationships are, and the more passionate and in love their relationship stays. So the research actually contradicts a whole set of assumptions that people are basing their practice on.
Well, thanks for that.
Yeah.
I have a curious question for you. You know, so many couples these days, they're just running to the altar, right? They get to know each other after about 6 months. There's a proposal, there's pressure. One wants to have kids, or they're, you know, they're early 30s, late 20s. And some of the stuff that I have read that seems to hold true is that it takes about 18 months to really get to know somebody in a way that you could even make that decision. Have you heard of that, or are you aware of that, or do you have different opinions?
Just speak to
that if you can, because it's always been really interesting to me what other people think.
I don't know of any research that suggests that it takes 18 months to really get to know somebody. I think really it depends on how deep the relationship is and how important the conversations they have are and how deep they go. Now, we're actually finishing a book called 8 Dates Toward a Lifetime of Love, in which we guide couples to have really important conversations about trust and commitment and conflict and play and adventure. And it seems to me that, you know, if couples are guided, there is no arbitrary time that it takes to get to know somebody in a deep way.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it logically, really, it depends on so many factors. It depends on how busy people are, how frequently they see one another, what kind of time they spend together. Are they just going to the movies together, or are they sitting face-to-face and texting other people, or, you know, are they actually just talking to one another at length about who they are? So, you know, there's a lot of factors that influence how well people know each other and how quickly they might go to the altar. Another factor, of course, is the history they're bringing into this new relationship. If they've been hurt deeply, say a betrayal in a past marriage, then they may take a whole lot longer to trust again and commit again. On the other hand, if they've only had really, you know, a few very positive experiences and they tend to be very trusting individuals, it may take less time. It's hard to know.
So it's interesting that you brought up infidelity, because I'm so curious about, for the most part, do you feel like when there's infidelity in a marriage, it truly means that the one person or both people are unhappy? Like, do you think that's a fair statement to say?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. It's interesting how to hear different perspectives. But do you think it's a symptom?
Well, there is research that suggests that happily married people have affairs, but that's really because the measurement of marital happiness is so deeply flawed. Tom Bradbury at UCLA has done research that shows that if you actually observe the couple, they may have high scores on their self-report inventory of marital satisfaction, but they really reveal their unhappiness in the way they interact with one another. So I think the conclusion you would draw on the basis of science is that the people who wind up having affairs really are in relationships that are somehow deeply unsatisfying to them. And loneliness is the best predictor of people having affairs.
Oh, very interesting. When you say also about self-report, that's a common occurrence in relationships where people think they're getting to know one another through their conversations, but then when they actually go out in the world together and interact in the ways that might really highlight who they said they were, and then see a contradiction in how they end up behaving, that causes often a lot of resentment and disappointment in the couple. Do you find that as well?
Yeah, absolutely, because in the beginning phase of falling in love, we secrete oxytocin, which is the hormone of bonding and cuddling. And oxytocin really calms the fear centers of the brain. It's also the hormone of very bad judgment. So we miss the red flags. Yes. We secrete oxytocin when we have orgasms in sex. And so we don't see the red flags. And so relationships initially, and when we studied 130 newlywed couples, all their arguments were about trust. Can I trust you? Will you be there for me? They're seeing the red flags now, and they're really asking the question, can I rely on you? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we don't see those red flags when we're, you know, in the throes of what psychologists call limerence, just infatuation. Mm-hmm. You agree, Julie?
Yeah, I do. I think that the good news, however, you know, regarding affairs, is that people can recover from affairs. We have developed a system of therapy that treats affairs specifically, and we've created a training for that for clinicians. And it's based on lots of research, not only ours, but a woman named Shirley Glass, who wrote a fabulous book called Not Just Friends, which really highlights the fact that people who have been betrayed experience all the signs of PTSD, which explains a lot of their reactions when they find out there is an affair. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be included in the treatment, the knowledge about that and how to help with that, as well as how important it is to build marriage number two. Marriage number one may be gone, but marriage number two is still possible with new ways of connecting to one another and staying transparent with one another and sharing much more in terms of emotional connection, as well as slowly but surely rebuilding physical connection.
Mm-hmm. I've definitely seen that to be true. That's a really good point, is that a lot of couples, if they really do the work and they understand, you know, what was the vacuum, that it didn't happen in a vacuum, and what did each do to contribute to that process and how to overcome that, mm-hmm. and get better, have much stronger relationships.
Yes.
You know, both people are transparent, they're accountable, they find new ways to demonstrate their language of love and receive mm-hmm. love differently. It can be so powerful. Not to say that everybody should go out there to have an affair and then be able to rekindle a beautiful relationship, but I've seen it happen too.
Yes,
it really
sure
is. It's so powerful.
So I'm curious.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Let me add one thing about that. I described this in the 10 Principles for Doing Effective Couples Therapy, the chapter on affairs, where what's really crucial, though, and some couple or some therapists might make the mistake about this, is first you have to have a phase of the therapy which is all about atonement. It's all about betrayed partner first asking questions of the person who had the affair to really fill in the gaps in the way that the person had the affair, what, you know, how much was spent on a gift, where it started, when, and so on, to kind of uncover what was secret. As much as they want to, and they also need to really be listened to. That betrayed partner needs to really be fully listened to regarding the feelings they have about it. And the other partner needs to really express remorse, sorrow, deep apologies, and that may go on for quite a while before they begin to reconstitute, okay, what should our marriage look like and what problems did we have in the marriage in the first place? Mm-hmm. If you go into why did the affair happen to begin with, then the person who was betrayed feels like they're being blamed for the affair.
Oh, so
that and that's
sense.
A huge mistake that will lead to couples dropping out of the therapy.
Right. Sorry if I misspoke. That was a given in my mind. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That has to occur before anything else can happen.
And do you advocate for knowing all of the details? Because I can imagine a lot of partners would want to know. I want to know everything. I want to know how many times, what happened.
You're like, when is full disclosure,
yes,
TMI?
Right, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, to some degree, you know, we leave that up to the betrayed partner with a caveat, mm-hmm. which is try not to ask questions about the nature of the actual sexual interaction itself. The reason for that is that the betrayed partner is already suffering PTSD in terms of the fantasies they have of their partner with the affair partner. They've already got a ton of pictures in their head, just imagined in fantasy and so on, that are plaguing them. They're like, flashbacks mm-hmm. that a Vietnam vet might have, except these are imagined images coming into their mind. And so if they ask questions about sex, they're going to get even more pictures that will traumatize them even further. So we suggest to people that they not ask questions about the actual sex, but everything else they can ask. And we leave that up to the person. Some people want to know more. Some people want to know less. But it shouldn't be up to a therapist to control that. That really needs to be up to the individual.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Very interesting.
It is interesting. Do you have any indicators that you see with a couple where somebody's had an affair where you're just say that this couple could just not get over this? Like, are there any signs or states of mind? Clearly, if the partner who did the betraying is not willing to be transparent and be in atonement and all that, are there others?
John?
If the betraying partner is not remorseful,
right?
I think that's really a problem, and we do see that occasionally. People feel that they have a right to have secrets. They have a right when they're unhappy or lonely to explore other relationships, and those people are very hard to treat.
It's so interesting. I worked with a couple who. It's a very interesting story, but they were a couple in their 30s, and she was questioning whether or not he had cheated on her, and basically had recorded an incidence of him cheating, basically an audio recording. And
of him having sex?
Yes, with somebody else, and he wouldn't admit to it.
Wow.
And so it was really interesting working with this couple because he was really saying this didn't happen. And, you know, we just so I said, you know, and we can get past this. We just, you know, she needs to hear that it happened. And he kept saying, no, it wasn't what it sounded like. And so it was just sort of interesting because it's so true. If you don't have that remorse or if you don't admit it, you can't really go on to the next step.
Did they stay together or did they break up?
I worked with them for 9 months.
Did they stay together?
They were still together when I was working with them. So, yeah, I mean, at one point I actually met with him privately and I said, you know, if you want to be honest here, I think we can get a lot farther. Like, because she was having a lot of trust issues and still just couldn't believe him. And he said to me, no, it didn't happen. I mean, he just was kind of sticking to his story. It was very interesting.
Wow. Do you think that sometimes, though, there's lack of remorse, like somebody who just feels total entitlement and they lack remorse, but I've also seen at times where the lack of remorse is really not so much a lack of remorse, it's that it's so paralyzingly shameful to acknowledge what they did when they really see the other pain that they created in their partner, that there comes with a lot of denial and kind of diminishment and all of that stuff. And have you noticed that ever as well?
Yeah, definitely. That is almost always, very often, you know, the first response. Mm-hmm. Because they assume that you, the therapist, are judging them the way they're judging themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they feel like you're in the pulpit, you know, you're pointing fingers, and you're not. You may be very empathetic, you may be very caring. And at the same time, because they're judging themselves so harshly, they imagine you are too.
Right.
So it's really important to bend over backwards as a therapist to say, no, that's not where I'm at. That's not what I'm feeling. I really understand that we are all human beings, that we have, you know, all made mistakes, huge mistakes. You don't need to crucify yourself. That's not what we're looking for.
Right.
Yeah, I go out of my way as a therapist to point out ways in which I've let people down and done things against my own morality. And Jews have a day every year, the atonement, where we do really take a look at ourselves. And I'm never at a loss for things I've done wrong. So, you know, I don't judge, you know, people, and I don't think Julie does either.
Yeah.
Now, do you ever practice together with a couple, the two of you with a couple?
Yeah, we do that. It's really, really fun. We have a wonderful time.
Cool.
John and I have been working together so long that we like to say that between the two of us, we have one cerebral cortex. And so when we are dealing with a couple, you know, we each know each other so well that we know when it's a good time for John to be the one who's intervening, when it's a good time for me, and when we have when we're not sure where John stands or I stand, we will openly have a little mini dialogue with each other in front of the couple to role model what it looks like to reach a decision about something. And that, too, is useful.
Mm-hmm. And they get to see what we up with each other.
Right, exactly.
But that's
unbelievable.
I was going to ask, do people
and
ask specifically?
On wears a yarmulke, which is really not a yarmulke, his little skull cap, it's actually a halo. Oh.
That's right. I'm always innocent.
But do people, does that bring questions where then the therapy's kind of turned around and it's about you as a couple and what your marriage is like? I can imagine that, you know, people must ask a ton of questions about your specific marriage.
As we are going to right now.
but we don't
you'll tell them. Yeah. But you'll tell us a little bit. How long have the two of you been married?
30 years.
Wow.
So you started to do your research together prior to being married. How did you guys meet?
Prior to being married? No, we didn't at all.
Oh, because it says 40 years of break.
So, we both moved to Seattle at about the same time and met in Seattle shortly after we each got here. I was an individual therapist primarily, just having gotten my PhD, and John was doing his research. And for 9 years, I had a very, very, very full practice, doing individual work with people deeply traumatized, people deeply troubled. Yeah, lots of folks who were personality disordered, who'd gone through, you know, pretty awful stuff. John was doing this research, and over dinner we would be talking and talking. And we were sitting out in the Pacific Ocean in a canoe one day, and we talked about the idea after 9 years of, gee, why don't we take some of these research findings and actually try to help people with them? And that's the time when we started working together, which was about 22 years ago or so, something like that.
That's awesome. And what's been the biggest challenge for the two of you in your marriage?
What's been the biggest challenge?
Yeah.
Well, probably working out our theory in our interventions in this work. Yeah. That's been hard because John was coming from a very different place. He was coming from a place of pure science, of you never do anything outside of the science. And I was coming from a place of, look, you know, realistically, this isn't how therapy works. You don't do it by prescription. You do it by what's happening in the moment and individual dynamics that kick into the relationship and so on. And so we fought like cats and dogs
Fighting is Jewish love.
Yes, exactly. That is
to work out all of our system of interventions. And, you know, here and there we still have differences about that.
But that's such a beautiful balance. I mean, no wonder it works with you two, right?
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Yeah, exactly. So far, 30 so years, so far, so good. Yeah.
Annoying. She's mostly right.
There's something we didn't cover that I'm really curious about. What is physiological calm in your version about, in your book, that you talk about that in The Science of Couples and Family Therapy?
Yeah. Well, it turns out that a really good predictor of the deterioration of a relationship is for them to be physiologically aroused, you know, have heart rates above 100 beats a minute, you know, high blood pressure, fast blood velocity, when they're arguing. And so they can't really listen to each other very well. Instead, they're sort of in attack or defensive mode. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the evidence is that when you get physiologically aroused, you really can't listen. You don't have access to your sense of humor. You're not a very creative problem solver. You yell, and thinking that if you raise the volume of your voice, you'll suddenly become more convincing. Yes. You repeat yourself, you'll become more convincing. So when people are flooded, you know, they really suck as listeners. And yeah. when you help them become, suddenly, you know, it's like they've had a brain transplant. They can listen, they're nice people, they can be kind, generous, compassionate. And you can't tell what somebody's heart rate is or blood velocity by looking at them.
Sure.
So you have to use these little gadgets, these pulse oximeters, to tell you what their heart rate is. Because when they're flooded, you know, they're not going to be able to do anything in therapy. And they don't have to be narcissistic to be bad listeners then.
Dr. John, can I purchase one of these for my children? I need two of these. I need them to see their heart rate and how flooded they get.
On Amazon.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, very effective.
That's it's like biofeedback, right? It's like just seeing, you know.
Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing.
When you were saying
that's right. In fact, we use a device that's made by a company called HeartMath that gives biofeedback and helps people learn how to self-soothe and how to calm down and be effective in when they control their breathing and also controlling their heart rate and their flooding.
What's the name of it, did you say, John?
A therapist really to know physiologically what's going on with their clients.
What is that product called again?
It's a pulse oximeter.
No, the HeartMath. M-Wave.
The M-Wave. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. It's called the M-Wave, which is spelled E-M-W-A-V-E, and it's made by a company called Heart, as in H-E-A-R-T, HeartMath.
Oh, awesome. That's
great.
That's so helpful, too.
Yeah, I think so, too. Wow.
It's funny when you were saying physiological arousal and people can't hear and they shout over each other. Well, that's why people like to be screamers during sex, right? I mean,
yeah.
They're not really listening, but they're screaming over one another.
Oh, that's so funny.
Believe it or not, we are pretty close to out of time here. So we definitely want to let you plug your products. We had you on today for the 10 principles for doing effective couples therapy, and then you have your new book coming out in 2018, The Science of Couples and Family Therapy. And where can people get the books and where can they find you?
They will be able to get the book. Where can Gottman. They get the book? At www.gottman.com, GOTTMAN.com. And at that website, we also have listed all of our clinical trainings, our couples workshops, and lots and lots of products that can be helpful for clinicians and couples. So thank you so very much.
Yes,
thank you so much.
Thank you so very much. Such a delight. We've been looking forward to the two of you coming on, and I'm so glad we got rewarded because we weren't sure as of this morning.
Yes, it's fabulous. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
All right. Awesome. Wow. Okay, and next week we have Corey Greathouse Sloan, the founder and president of Life Uncommon. Many surprises in that one because we're not exactly sure what kind of wonderful information she's going to bring our way, but we are excited about it. All right, any great upcoming plans this week?
This week, what is this week? No, but I'm excited for Halloween in a couple
of
weeks.
Oh, of course.
That's
you
our
are.
Favorite.
Your kids are they already have their costumes, and I know you will not tell us because you do a family costume.
I will not tell, but I get them in August. It's like sick. It's sickness.
Someday you will reveal that secret to me and only me.
Yes, actually,
when you get it.
Maybe that's not a bad idea.
Just so you have one person you can share about it, right? Because mum's the word. I'm a great therapist.
Yes.
I don't say anything if you tell me not to. Well, I actually had canceled my trip because of Prowler this week, so we were going to go to Oregon, but we are going to take a little mini break
up to
Santa Barbara, so we're close by, and our cat sitter, I've already showed her how to do all the medicines and all that kind of stuff.
Perfect.
And boy, if he doesn't doesn't puke anymore this week, then it'd be like so exciting. Very good, everybody. Thank you also for listening to my tales of Mr. Prowler, because
and
he is
follow us
such
on
a
Instagram,
sweetie.
Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly, at Twitter at DocTherapist1, and on Facebook, the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show.
Love
All
you.
Right, thanks
Have
so
a great
much.
Week. Bye bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.